This is The Irrationally Exuberant. I'm Reed Messerschmidt.
Gather round and I will spin a tale too often told. As long ago as Icarus, as recently as John Travolta. About a man whose thirst for wealth and fame could not be quenched, till in the river Genesis hopes and dreams were drenched. They called him Yankee Leaper, though Sam Batchy was born, because he jumped from such great heights to water far below. He gained such notoriety, was known throughout the land, but come with me back to the day his run of luck went bad.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, allow me to introduce myself. I'm the world-renowned Yankee Leaper, King of the Catapult, Tsar of the Far-Off, Boss of the Bodily Toss, President of the Precipice, Emperor of Escalating Elevations. You good sirs and madams may call me Sam Patch. Now, the more learned folks assembled know my motive for perching above you on this precarious platform. 125 deadly feet above the hungry, roaring depths of the ninth wonder of God's world, these irate falls of the Genesee River. You have doubtless seen the advertisements plastered about this good town, read the flyers and pamphlets strewn throughout these dusty city streets. But for the benefit of the ignorant rabble among you, those not blessed with book learning, allow me to restate my purpose. I, Sam Patch, will presently, on this, the 16th day of October in the year of our Lord, 1829, perform the most magnificent feat ever attempted in this great land of ours, or elsewhere for that matter. I intend to leap from this damp platform 125 feet above the stormy falls of the Grand River Genesee to the roiling waters far below. A feat so daring, so bold, let us not mince words, ill-considered, that it was not dreamt of by even history's greatest men. Not that wooden tooth leader, George Washington. He may have bested the dastardly English, but as far as I can tell, the greatest height from which he ever leaped was the back of a horse. What is that? 4 feet at most? Shameful! Not old King Arthur! Pulling swords from a stone is impressive, no doubt, but show me one instance from those ancient tales in which he jumped from anything at all. What kind of a man is that? And certainly not Jesus Christ. The general mechanics of his water walking aren't entirely clear to me, but I can't but imagine that he would have splattered upon the water's surface as though it were made of solid steel. What a mess! What a fool! Now, as you well know, this is not my first leap. Far from it. I've leapt from towering buildings, the masts of great ships, and over the mighty gush of Niagara. I have gained fame and acclaim throughout this glorious nation and beyond. A man may travel to any corner of the world and hear the praises of Sam Patch sung from the rooftops and raved of in the papers. But today, with 10,000 sets of anxious eyes watching, I will make my greatest leap of all and assure my seat in the annals of history. Ere I attempt this glorious leap, allow me to introduce you to my friends. The stout, furry fellow next to me is Mayor Bertram Clawford III. He's a bear, as I'm sure you've noticed. and one of the finest drinking companions you'd ever hope to meet, as well as an absolute humdinger with the ladies. Why, I've seen Mayor Clawford down 57 pints and still stand to engage in deeds that'd make your skin crawl with the most beautiful women you'd ever care to meet. It was really quite shocking and disconcerting. Ain't that the truth, Mayor? Let's have a cheer for the mayor! And right here, allow me to stoop to hoist him up for you. He's the diminutive old chap. Is Mr. Fox Trottington, a fox, ladies and gentlemen. He's not good for much of anything, but what say you we toss this dim-witted scoundrel over these grand falls to wet our whistles, so to speak? First man to pull him from the river gets to make of him a hat. What say you? Well, Mr. Trottington, I do believe that sounds like a yay. Off you go! And what about the mayor? Shall we see him make the jump? What say you, mayor? Need a push? Here go! What a splash! I would not advise attempting to make the mayor into a hat. He's more liable to make one of you, dear friends. Ha ha! See him swim, an elegant beast indeed. Now, ladies, now, gentlemen, it is time for me to follow my friends. Notice that a hat is being passed among you. Do not be stingy. Not like the crowd yesterday. Short arms, long pockets, the lot of them. Remember, your generosity puts the victuals on my plate, as it were. And what victuals? Allow me to remove my jacket and a kiss for the flag of these United States. I'll leave you with these words. Words you doubtless now know by rote. Some things can be done as well as others. Take it to heart. Never forget it. I'll see you all upon the shore. There is no mistake in Sam Patch. And a one, and a two, and a three.
Ladies and gentlemen, dearly beloved, we are gathered here upon this consecrated ground on this somber occasion to remember Sam Patch, yes, but also to observe the dire lessons his life may teach us, God's own flock. Mr. Patch was fond of shouting to anyone who would listen, and even those that would have rather not, "Some things can be done as well as others." This phrase is meaningless, of course, or in any case so banal as to make no point at all. But let us consider something it misses. Some things, though they can be done, should not be done. Hurling a trained fox, a trained bear, and oneself from a great height above a waterfall and into a river, for instance. Or spending one's time drinking and whoring about with the previously mentioned trained bear. Or purchasing a trained bear in the first place. Sam came from poverty. It says something of his potential that he transcended that. His father was a mean drunk, and that's a tough lot. But he did not transcend that. Sam was about as mean a drunk as you could find. And the way he paraded around that bear. Sweet Jesus, forgive him. And that's all I have to say about Sam Patch. He was a drunkard, a braggart, and a fool. He also, to his credit, I suppose, jumped from some very high places for what that's worth. I believe this crude wooden grave marker says it all. Sam Patch, such is fame. God rest his soul. Amen. Sam Patch was an American original, the first daredevil, the Yankee Leaper. He couldn't have existed in any time or place other than New England in the early 19th century, and it's insane that he existed even there. The man made his living jumping off of things into water and had a pet bear that he made do the same. Kind of like a base jumper, but not at all like that, really. Less flashy, more primitive, and with a bear. Also, crowds don't gather around to watch some chisel-jawed dude bro fly off a mountain using science. Sam Patch didn't use science. There's a solid chance that Sam Patch didn't even know what science was. The man couldn't read. He'd just take a few slugs of the demon rum, slide out of his top coat, and hop from somewhere pretty high into whichever body of water was handy. And why did he do it? As with so many things, boredom at first. The early 1800s were not inherently boring, of course. Western migration provided plenty of opportunity for the industrious. Our nation was finding its identity, and the native genocide was in full swing, which must have been a real hoot. But entertainment and fun had yet to be invented, and Sam was a poor kid with an alcoholic father named Mayo Greenleaf Patch. Everyone was an alcoholic or an opium addict back then on account of the boredom and the fact that all of their medicines were primarily alcohol and opiates. This hasn't actually changed much. But the lack of supervision and a consistent income meant that by the age of 7, Sam was working at a cotton mill. Imagine that. When he was done with a 13-hour shift at the cotton mill, when he was 7, remember, he'd go home and, I don't know, eat some stew or something and listen to somebody read the Bible and then go to bed probably. And then he'd wake up and go back to spinning cotton. My point is that this was a very different time, which is an obvious point, but can you even imagine? Folks stuck in one place without much connection to the goings-on outside of their household were mostly just left to wait for tuberculosis to take them to their great reward. So Patch began to jump from things. It started at work. He'd jump over the mill dam to amuse his coworkers, all of them children, presumably. The things he jumped off of got higher and higher, and the crowds got bigger as word spread. He would jump from the masts of ships and buildings and over waterfalls, and, well, basically that was it. The list of high things to spring from into water is limited. Folks seemed to enjoy watching him fall, so at some point he decided to make it into a career. He acquired a manager, basically just a squirrely fellow with a big mouth, access to a printing press and nothing else to do, who would advertise his jumps and pass a hat around the audience. Busking, essentially. And it worked. His manager billed him as something of a gentleman jumper, promoting his feats with posters and handbills and soliciting write-ups in the local paper. He'd set a time and a place, and once a sufficient crowd had amassed, he'd send the hat around, address the crowd, remove his jacket, and leap, feet first and straight as an arrow. Somewhere along the line, he bought a tamed bear, which he would send out in front of him. You'd think this would diminish from the impressiveness of his own jump, but I guess it didn't, because he soon added a trained fox. He took to saying things like, "Some things can be done as well as others," which is meaningless, but nonetheless became a popular American phrase for a time, and "there's no mistake in Sam Patch," which would prove to be pretty ironic. In 1829, he completed his greatest jump, over Niagara Falls. His first attempt was thwarted by inclement weather and was scheduled for later in the day. He completed the jump, but the crowd was not to his satisfaction, so he scheduled it again for the next day. This time, 10 10,000 people showed up. 10,000. That is a shitload of people. He managed to take in $50. His ego stoked, he began acting significantly less gentlemanly, drunkenly stumbling into a town 2 days before a jump, parading around his bear and his fox, terrorizing whorehouses, and generally causing trouble. But his fame continued to grow. U.S. President and noted genocidal maniac Andrew Jackson named a horse after him. On November 6, 1829, Sam Patch's inevitable end was set in motion. He intended to leap 100 feet over the falls of the Genesee River in Rochester and leap over the falls he did, right after his bear. There were 8,000 people at the jump, but he raised less money than he'd hoped, less than $50, presumably. So he scheduled another jump for a week later, which happened to be Friday the 13th. This time, he would jump from a platform 25 feet above the previous point, his farthest fall yet. The day came, rainy and overcast, but another 8,000 especially rowdy spectators came to watch. Not a few jeered at him, and Sam was good and drunk, so he decided to go through with the jump despite the weather. Out of spite, the greatest motivator of them all. He climbed to the platform, shaking in the wind, accompanied by his animals. He made his speech, removed his jacket, kissed the flag, and leapt. At first, it seemed that the dive was going just as well as all those before it, but then Sam disappeared behind the falls mist, and when he emerged, he was flailing. The crowd gasped as he tumbled, ass over ankles towards the water, and landed with a loud splat. They waited in silence for him to emerge, but he didn't for another 6 months, when a farmer found his frozen body several miles downriver while watering his horses. And that was the end of Sam Patch. He was buried in Charlotte Cemetery, marked only by a wooden plank inscribed with the words, "Sam Patch, such is fame." Even the marker is gone now. But the story of Sam Patch lived on for a time. Like a post-colonial Elvis, rumors that he survived and hid out in a cave beneath the falls persisted for years. Sightings were reported well into the latter part of the century. He entered the canon of minor American folk heroes like Gorgeous George and the Jolly Green Giant. Poems and stories were written of his feats. He appeared in works by Melville, Hawthorne, William Carlos Williams, and a series of plays depicting his life became popular for a while. They toured the country for years. And then, as is almost always the case with people at a certain tier of celebrity, the memory of Sam Patch faded away. Is there a lesson here? Perhaps. How about this? No matter what stupid shit you get into, nobody will give a good goddamn about you in 100 years. Probably less. Probably like a week after you're dead. And that's okay. Because you're dead, so what's it to you? Here's to Sam Patch.
As you know, Sam Patch purchased a trained bear he would use in his act to toss from whatever he was going to jump from prior to his own jump. Not a great life. Well, it got me to thinking, if Sam Patch were around today, where would he go to buy a trained bear? And I think the answer to that is obviously Craigslist. So I'd like to take you now to a conversation between a bear breeder and Sam Patch in regards to the purchase of a trained bear. Hello? Yes, this is Graydon Camacho. Who am I speaking with? You say your name is Sam Patch. All right, and you're wondering about the Craigslist ad, I see. I've posted several. Would you Would you like to buy the My Little Ponies? No. No, not the ponies. Are you sure? They're beautiful, really shapely and colorful, and their hair is so, so soft. You're sure? Well, if you're calling about the meetup behind Chubby Lou's Adult Emporium, there's no need to RSVP. You can just show up. Me and the rest of the fellas will be there at 11 Tuesday night, just like the ad says. Bring your My Little Pony getup. Not the meetup behind Chubby Lou's Adult Emporium. The butt plug? You know, why don't you just tell me which ad you're talking about? Oh, the bear. Well, why don't you forget those other things I just mentioned? The bear is $4,000. A real bargain. In this economy, you know, trained bears can go for... What's that? You want to know his name. It's Barry White. No, he's brown. It's just a clever name. Well, you know the singer with the deep voice? He's saying, can't get enough of your love? His name's Barry. It's a synonym, see? Right. Is there anything else I can tell you about him? Yes, he has all of his teeth. Great question. What's that? He's 2 years old. About 3 feet tall at the moment. Yes, he'll grow, bears grow, just like anything else. Well, I can't say exactly. 6 feet, maybe? I usually sell them off before then. No, I'm not a bear expert, just a hobbyist of sorts. Well, I've never seen him in a top hat, but I'm sure he wouldn't mind. He couldn't tell you if he did, in any case. I think the same would go for a bow tie and sport coat, yes. Again, I've never seen it, but I do believe bears can swim. Afraid of heights? I couldn't say. He's a very friendly sort. I certainly don't see any reason why he wouldn't get along with a fox. I see. Well, this might not be any of my business, but I've just got to ask you what you intend to do with the bear. You intend to toss it from very high places into water. May I ask why? To prime the crowd. Fair enough. Mr. Patch, I think we've got a deal. Are you sure I can't change your mind about the My Little Ponies?
Sam Patch was America's first daredevil, but he wasn't the last. Inspired by his feats of daring do, many others attempted to earn their keep through stunts of varying impressiveness and with varying success. These are a few of their stories. Al Dagonda Marsha Weird was Patch's first and arguably most successful successor, as well as the only notable woman in American history since Betsy Ross, according to most history books. A 26-year-old Dutch immigrant, she arrived in the United States alone after her entire family was killed in a rare Nederlander bar brawl and was in attendance for Patch's final jump at the Genesee Falls. Astounded by the crowds and the amount of money raised,
$50 was more than she'd ever seen, let alone in a hat. But unimpressed by Sam and indifferent to his death, she tracked down his manager the next day and told him she supposed he needed some new talent, considering the circumstances. The manager, an astoundingly greasy professional huckster of indeterminate origin named, fittingly, almost too fittingly, Snidely Cash Groveler, agreed and asked what she proposed. "Well," she responded, "I was thinking that maybe we could fling me from a catapult." And so they did, eventually. They commissioned a large catapult. Catapult builderies were as common then as Radio Shacks are today, which is to say, not all that common, but much more so than is logical, and set to work rebranding Eldegonda as Catapult Annie, a devil-may-care firebrand with a taste for danger. She took to wearing a precursor to the modern jumpsuit made of hot, scratchy burlap painted red, white, and blue, with whalebone buttons up the front and an enormous hat fashioned from an entire stuffed peacock, its plumage fully splayed. Even before her first catapulting, Catapult Annie was a national sensation thanks to the posters and flyers Cash Groveler had delivered by Pony Express to every major city and a brief but very public affair with Jedediah Smith. She began making money just by coming to a town to give a talk, kind of a brash 19th century stand-up routine, the content of which has not survived today. Peacock hats became wildly popular among American women, and jumpsuits were adopted by both sexes. Andrew Jackson owned several and was often criticized for wearing them to meetings with foreign dignitaries. Her catchphrase, "Toss me, don't cross me," which she and Cash Groveler came up with after several pints at a Pennsylvania tavern, caught on almost as widely as some things can be done as well as others. A year passed, and distracted by her newfound notoriety, Annie had yet to be catapulted even once. Political cartoons began to depict her gadding about while her catapult sat idle, covered in cobwebs, so she and Cash Groveler decided they had better fling her and fast. They announced that the big event would occur at noon on the 4th of July, 1831, during the massive Field Point celebration in Greenwich, Connecticut. When the day arrived, a huge crowd assembled. Some estimate that as many as 11,000 were in attendance. The catapult was set up on the shore of Long Island Sound. She was to be flung into the water where a boat waited to rescue her. At 11:45, Annie climbed into its cupola to address the crowd. It was a rousing speech and included the first known coinage of the phrase, "All's well that ends well." Following a rollicking round of applause, Annie laid down in the cupola while Cash Groveler prepared to launch her. She was, for the first time in her life, scared. They'd only tested the machine once with Patch's ill-used pet bear, and it hadn't gone well. But there wasn't time to rejigger the device, and it was agreed that the water would be a softer landing surface than the pine forest where Mayor Bertram Crawford III had met his, pardon the pun, grisly demise. The catapult's lever was pulled, and Catapult Annie was propelled into the ground 20 feet in front of it. She exploded like a ripe melon dropped just outside of the grocery store, showering her manager and the front rows of the crowd in blood and peacock feathers. South of the catapultostrophe, as it came to be known, in Richmond, Virginia, Silence Barebone, another brash young nincompoop, was just getting his start in the daredevil game, but had come up with a much more metaphysical take on the burgeoning profession. Barebone, a Puritan-descended opium addict from a long line of Puritan opium addicts, was dead broke in 1831. He'd tried his hand at everything from barbary to hostlery to haberdasherism, but his habit kept getting in the way, and despite his significant gift for gab, he'd run out of friends to hit up for jobs and hopeless loans. On top of this, he'd recently lost his left leg below the knee in a horrific run-in with a murder of crows and was now limping about on a crude monkey's arm peg leg, so named because it was made from the humerus bone of a poached yellow baboon. It was carved in such a way that it could be removed and used as an opium pipe in a pinch. Silence was stumbling around the muddy streets of Richmond in an opium haze. He'd stolen a bottle of Reverend Pappy Chappy's old-time good-time healthifying American tonic, which was about 90% opium, earlier that day. When he came across a weathered poster advertising one of Patch's jumps, he stared at it for a very long time. The image of Patch began to speak to him.
"Give it a go, you battered ragamuffin. If folks would pay 2 bits to see me hop into some water, imagine what they'd cough up to see what it is you'd like to do. Remember, some things can be done as well as others, Silence. Show them what's in your soul."
Right then and there, Silence tossed his bowler hat head hole up onto the street and began to shout,
"Come on, come all! Witness the most daring act attempted by a mere mortal since ever! I grow weary of the tyranny of our great creator, as do the most of you good folks, I'm sure. Don't wince, don't walk away. I know he has harmed you. You, sir, he gave you that hideous face. And you, madam, do you not hate him for the disgusting body he bequeathed upon me? Just look at what he's done to me. God, in his so-called infinite wisdom, can take my livelihood. He can have my leg. But I'll no longer sit idly by while the monster in the sky runs rampant. Even the God of all creation cannot quiet Silence."
A confused passerby, assuming that Silence was a raving street person, which, in all fairness, he was, took pity and tossed a coin into his hat, and Silence Barebone went off. Head tilted to the sky, arms flailing wildly, feet stomping, he began to curse God with all the force his lungs could muster. It was quite a spectacle. He called God names like shithead and shit for brains and shitty, shitty shitface. Now, this may not seem very daring today, but at the time, folks took the Bible very literally and believed in a preposterously interventionist God, one who would strike a man dead where he stood for an idle thought or wayward glance at a passing damsel. Old-timey people were pretty much across the board ignorant rubes and always scared, which, in their defense, they had every right to be. The world was a giant garbage pile right up until the moment when air conditioning was invented. And so they were shocked, appalled, and in many cases, secretly admiring of Silence for his blasphemous screams. Many crossed themselves and hurried away. Some kneeled to pray. Most just stood staring, mouths agape. Finally, two burly men wrestled him to the ground and held his mouth shut until he calmed down. When the crowd dispersed, he dusted himself off and found that he'd collected $3 in his hat. Not a fortune, certainly, but enough to get him loaded for a few days. And apparently, since he had yet to be struck down, God hadn't really noticed his outburst. Or maybe he just didn't care. Or maybe there was no God. This thought was a shock to Silence, whose parents had raised him to believe absolutely despite their errant ways. But after a few slugs of his opium juice, it started to make a lot of sense. He planned to try his stunt again, but died 3 days later of an overdose. Kitch Figley hated bees. All bees, from bumble to honey, but especially the now extinct giant North American mason bee, so named because its stripes form the Masonic symbol of the square and compass on its rear left abdomen, and it was huge, up to 7 inches long and 4 inches tall, with a wingspan of 8 inches and weighing as much as 4 grams. Its stinger could leave a hole in a man the size of a platypus's butthole or the diameter of a blueberry. Which is what one did to Figley on the morning of his 9th birthday in April of 1812. The bee was his pet prior to stinging him. Many folks kept these massive bees as pets in those days, and he paraded it about on a small leash woven from marsh grass. Its name was Beetle Bailey. The popular slothful and seemingly eyeless comic strip character is named for the bee, incidentally. And the two would spend many happy hours frolicking and skylarking amid the griddleberry trees on the Figley homestead. Kitch loved that bee. So you can imagine his horror when one day, while he was napping under a griddleberry tree, belly filled with delicious griddleberries, Beetle Bailey up and stung him. Jolted from sleep, he shrieked in pain and instinctively swatted at its source, squashing his beloved, traitorous pet whose guts exploded all over the poor boy. Wailing like a platypus with a blueberry in its butthole, he ran inside, arms swelling and face dripping with bee innards, where his horrified parents immediately treated the wound with Reverend Pappy Chappy's old-time, good-time, healthifying American tonic. He was laid up for a month, but lucky to survive and high as fuck. From that day on, Kitch Figley killed every bee he saw. He killed them with rocks, sticks, shovels, kicks, slaps, headbutts, and fire. He once tricked a larger bee into stinging a smaller one, killing them both. He began seeking out beehives, carefully, silently climbing above them and killing every bee inside by dousing them in Reverend Pappy Chappy's old-time good-time healthifying American tonic. When he'd murdered every bee in Scuttlebutter County, he began traveling further to seek and destroy them, from Bumfrick, Maine, all the way down to Jitterpit, South Carolina. He left a trail of bee carcasses and hive flakes in his wake. Word of his brutal rampage traveled quickly. The nation's beekeepers quaked within their burlap bee suits, and honey lovers urged Congress to pass bee abuse laws, but Congress was preoccupied with trying to come up with a better name for the War of 1812, which they never did. After 5 years of this, Kitch Figley was dead broke and without any marketable skills outside of bee killing, which there wasn't much call for. Besides, his face and hands had become hideously bulbous and twisted from all of the stings he had endured, while his body remained strong and sinewy, and his calves enormously muscled from all of the travel by foot. He was a sight for sore eyes, and his eyes were sore from all the crying. You see, each time Kitch killed a bee, it brought him back to that fateful day under the griddleberry tree, and the tears poured down his lumpy face like rain over a moldy old loaf of marble rye. But, as luck would have it, Figley ran into the infamous Snidely Cash Groveler on his way back up north, and the two hatched a plan. Kitch Figley would, in front of a crowd of thousands, be locked in a cage with 500 deadly giant North American mason bees and pummel them all to death lest he be stung into the afterlife. The fight was scheduled for August 4th, 1817, and Cash Groveler went into his default promotion mode. When the day came, though, only 250 were in attendance. While folks were plenty eager to see the famed bee-killing freak get killed by bees, they were also deathly afraid of being stung themselves. No amount of reassurance could convince them to risk it. Figley considered backing out, but Cash Groveler managed to shake down the crowd for $14, and he was in no position to turn down that kind of money. He stood in the center of the 50 by 50 foot cage, already weeping, and the crowd held its breath as the barrel of bees was rolled to the cage's edge and placed inside. Cash Groveler locked the door. Without a word, only several horrifying screams, he stomped his massive calves down onto the wooden planks and smashed the barrel to bits, releasing the bees. Many in the crowd ran, a few fainted, as Kitch Figley began punching and kicking wildly as the dazed bees flew in all directions trying to escape. Sweat and tears streaming down his face, he killed bee after bee, their innards exploding outwards, coating the cage's floor and the audience, and especially Figley. He barely looked human, like some creature from Dr. Moreau's Island, as he sobbed and screamed and swatted. After only 15 minutes, it seemed as though every last bee was dead. He roared victoriously and then crumbled to his knees, bawling, crippled by regret, and screaming over and over,
"Beetle Bailey! I just want my Beetle Bailey!"
And then he gasped, sat bolt upright, his eyes wide with pain, surprise, terror, and he collapsed again, lifeless. A single mason bee was clinging to the back of his head, its stinger buried deep in his spinal column. Kitch Figley died, as all daredevils must, at the hand of his muse.